Well, we're up to our fourth sermon in our series on discipleship. And I wonder, I have a question for us. I wonder, as we consider what it looks like to be a disciple of Jesus, as we consider what it looks like to respond to Jesus, I wonder what responses to Jesus you've seen maybe in your own life. I wonder what responses you've seen to Jesus' call to discipleship perhaps in the lives of people around you. I was thinking about this and reflecting on it, and for me, someone whose response to Jesus' call to discipleship, their response that really stands out for me is my grandfather. You see, my papa greatly encouraged me in his faith simply through how he lived as a disciple of Jesus. When I was a kid, whenever we came down to Melbourne, because we lived in the country, whenever we came down to Melbourne to visit Papa, I always remember his Bible being open somewhere, on the dining table, on the kitchen bench. It was always open somewhere. And almost every page of that Bible, I'd sneakily look at it when he wasn't looking, on almost every page of his Bible was his scrawly handwriting, notes in the margins from talks or sermons he'd listened to, questions about verses that he had, on almost every page. And when I was a teenager and we came down to visit Papa in Melbourne and his Bible was always open somewhere on the table, I remember trying to think of a nice way of asking him, "Papa, how can you still, i.e. at your age, be learning about Jesus? Surely by now you've learnt all there is to know about Jesus." And I remember he laughed, which relieved me because I was worried that I would be insulting him about his age, but he laughed and then he just smiled and he said, "Ah, Christine, we never stop learning. That's the beauty of the gospel." See, my papa didn't understand everything, but he faithfully followed. And then as a young adult, I visited Papa again, this time in hospital. He was about to go in for a biopsy on the cancer in his brain. And that was the cancer that would take him home to his Lord a couple of years later. And as he was about to be wheeled off for this biopsy on his brain, I asked if I could pray for him. And he said yes, and I prayed for him. And then he turned around and he quoted the blessing from Numbers 6 to me. He said to me, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine on you and be gracious to you. The Lord turn his face toward you and give you peace." I should have been quoting that to him. He was the one who was about to go off into surgery for this biopsy, and yet he was quoting this blessing to me. See, Papa to me was a great example of someone faithfully responding to Jesus' call to discipleship. Now, of course, I could give you lots of other positive examples of friends or people from church or family. I could certainly give you plenty of negative examples of people dear to me whose response shows that their own agenda in this world is to them more attractive or more important than following Jesus. Examples of people who found the teaching of Jesus to be perhaps too hard, perhaps insulting, and found it easier to desert Jesus than to follow him. And I'm sure we all know plenty of those examples as well. In this sermon series on discipleship, we're asking the big questions around following Jesus. What does this mean? What does it mean and look like for each of us individually, as well as a community, to be and to live as Jesus followers? How are we shaped by this? How do we continue to grow in our role of Christ's disciples? So far, we've looked at the call of discipleship, when Jesus calls people to follow him. It's a call that focuses on Jesus and who he is and what he has done. And that call to follow him means a commitment to a God who wants to be in relationship with us. Last week, Dave preached for us. Thanks, Dave. I don't think he's here, but thanks, Dave. And Dave shared that it's only by the grace of God that we can enter into a discipleship relationship. Discipleship's not for the faint-hearted. It's a narrow road, and on that road, we're forced to confront who or what we put our trust in, just like the rich man from the passage last week. Our passage today is John chapter 6. If you've got your Bibles open in front of you, that will be really helpful. Already in his gospel, we're only up to chapter 6, and already in his gospel, John has been painting a very powerful picture of Jesus. You see, John wants to tell us about Jesus. Why? So that we might believe. That's the whole purpose of John writing his book. He states this himself. You might recall John chapter 20, verses 30 to 31. John wants to tell us about Jesus so that we might believe. You see, John's setting up this question for his readers. He's setting up this question for us. And the question John is asking is this: who do you believe Jesus is? What will your response to Jesus be? There's a lot of characters at play in chapter 6, and we're going to see how different people respond to Jesus. And hopefully in that, to be encouraged to think about how we want to respond to him. Not just that one-off response when we choose to become a follower of Jesus, but that ongoing decision, that ongoing response to be a disciple of Jesus. What kind of response does the call to discipleship require for each of us? Well, let's jump into the text. I'm going to read for us from verse 1. After this, Jesus crossed over to the far side of the Sea of Galilee, also known as the Sea of Tiberias. A huge crowd kept following him wherever he went because they saw his miraculous signs as he healed the sick. Then Jesus climbed a hill and sat down with his disciples around him. See, Jesus' ministry is attracting attention. Jesus is meeting people's physical needs through his miracles, and it's drawing a crowd. When in verse 2 it says that a huge crowd kept following him wherever he went, this isn't the same sort of follow that the disciples have committed to, where we heard from 2 weeks ago that they left everything to follow Jesus. No, here some of the crowd, they might be enjoying his teaching, some may be curious or puzzled and they want to learn more. Some may be there just to see what Jesus will do next. What else is this Jesus capable of? What will be the next miracle? Jesus is possibly retreating to the other side of the lake and up the hill for some quiet time or some rest. We know from Mark's account of this miracle that the disciples had just returned from a pretty successful preaching mission trip around Galilee. So they're probably tired. So they've crossed to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, and the crowd have followed around the top of the lake, possibly an hour or two walk to where Jesus was resting with his disciples. What does Jesus do next? Let me read from verse 5. Jesus soon saw a huge crowd of people coming to look for him. Turning to Philip, he asked, "Where can we buy bread to feed all these people?" So he was testing Philip, for he already knew what he was going to do. Philip replied, "Even if we worked for months, we wouldn't have enough money to feed them." Then Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up. "There's a young boy here with 5 barley loaves and 2 fish. But what good is that with this huge crowd?" Now, it's not immediately obvious from John's account of this miracle as to why Jesus wants to feed this large crowd. But this account is also recorded in the Synoptic Gospels. Did you know that this miracle and the resurrection are the only 2 miracles that are recorded in all 4 Gospels? I think there's something special, there's something important about this miracle that John and the other Gospel writers want us to know about. But the accounts in the Synoptic Gospels, in Matthew and Mark and Luke, of this miracle, they add some helpful detail for us. See, Jesus sees the crowd coming, and instead of retreating away from them, or instead of sending the crowd away, no, instead Jesus teaches them, and he healed their sick. Mark tells us in chapter 6, verse 34, that Jesus had compassion on the crowd because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So having spent the day with Jesus, it's late, the crowd are hungry, and they're in a pretty remote place on the other side of the lake. And so Jesus turns to Philip and asks, "Where can we buy bread to feed all these people?" Philip reveals that he has no idea how to feed such a large crowd, No one would have enough money to feed that many mouths, so many mouths. And just in case by this point we haven't cottoned on to the situation, it's highlighted even further by Andrew. The tiny meal brought by the young boy was ludicrously inadequate to the need. What's needed here is nothing short of a miracle. And in case we fall into the trap of thinking Jesus has in front of him a genuine conundrum, verse 6 quickly follows. See, Jesus knows exactly what he's going to do. And we all know what happens next, don't we? He takes this small meal from the young boy, the 5 loaves and the 2 bits of fish, and he gives thanks to God for the food, and then he gives it to the people, where they all ate until they were satisfied. And still, there was abundantly more left over than what there was to start with that tiny meal. This miracle is typically called the feeding of the 5,000, but there were probably at least 10 to 15,000 people, if not more, as the 5,000 only included the men, not the women and the children. This miracle has purpose on 2 different levels. Firstly, this miracle functions in the immediate earthly purpose, and second, it has an eternal purpose, which Jesus' teaching in the rest of chapter 6 highlights. I thought about reading all of chapter 6, but I think it's 71 verses, so I thought maybe I'll just allude to a few of them as we go. But let's look firstly at the earthly purpose of this miracle, because it's important that we don't play down the earthiness of Jesus' miracles. Jesus sees this hungry crowd of people in front of him. They needed food, and he has compassion for them. Jesus consciously, passionately wants to feed these people. He wants their tummies filled, and this is not just so that they will see he is the Messiah. He's meeting the need in front of them, in front of him. And the people in front of him, the crowd, if they're mostly made up of people from the surrounding area, which is likely of Galilee, then they're probably quite poor. The Galileans were mostly peasants. They laboured hard for a subsistence wage, and they were primarily focused on the down-to-earth matters. Where's our next meal going to come from? Matters of food, means of livelihood. The food, the small meal that the boy brings to Andrew and Jesus, the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, that was food of the poorer classes. The barley loaves were more like small little dry scones, not like Ellen's scones, I hear, but small little dry cakes of bread. The fish was probably a tiny pickled fish, more like a relish or something on the side. This was the food of the poorer classes. You see, Jesus doesn't distinguish between who he will feed, who he will touch, who he will heal, who he will teach. No, Jesus is responding to people's earthly felt needs, and he's doing it as a loving, compassionate God. Well, I said there were two things to draw out from this miracle. That was the first one, that earthly need. And the second, much more important side to this miracle is the eternal purpose. This eternal purpose was missed by many of the original hearers, the people that were there with Jesus, and I don't want us to be in that camp today. John tells us when this miracle happens, and it's really easy to miss the significance of when it happens. Did you notice that? It's even in brackets in the NLT. Verse 4 says that it was nearly time for the Jewish Passover celebration. Passover was a big deal. It was this great patriotic festival which stirred the Jews' sense of national identity. There's anticipation and celebration as they remember one of the most significant times in the history of their people. What are they remembering? If our kids' own kids were here, hopefully they could tell you. We've been doing it over the last term. Central to the Passover story is being miraculously freed from Egypt under Moses' leadership. This is from Exodus. And then God miraculously providing for his people by sending down manna from heaven for them to eat. And he sent down manna from heaven for them to eat every single day for 40 years as they wandered around in the wilderness. That's Exodus chapter 16, verse 35. Can you see some parallels here between the feeding from heaven in the wilderness with Jesus feeding the crowd in our miracle story today? See, the crowd that Jesus feeds are a multitude, not unlike those who were fed the manna. Jesus and his disciples and the crowd are in a fairly remote location, like the Israelites were in the wilderness. And the crowd that had come around the top of the lake to follow Jesus and to be present there for that miracle, they're making these connections too. This is why the crowd exclaims in verse 14, "Surely, surely he is the prophet we have been expecting." The Old Testament text that they're referring to is Deuteronomy chapter 18, where Moses tells the people that God has promised to raise up another prophet like Moses. And after what the crowd has seen Jesus do, here he is. This must be him, the prophet who supersedes Moses. But Jesus didn't want to stop there. And so for the rest of John chapter 6, Jesus engages the crowds and his disciples in a theological explanation of the meaning of the miracle, the eternal meaning of the miracle. See, the people have understood so far on a material level, seeing Jesus as the next prophet, and they weren't wrong in seeing that, but Jesus wants to lift his hearers above a material understanding to spiritual truths. He wants to talk about not simply earthly material food, but the greater food that lasts forever. So here's the line of Jesus' teaching and thinking. I'm not going to read through all of John chapter 6, but I'm just going to summarise it for us to help us see the flow and the train of argument in Jesus' teaching and thinking. So first, there's the manna that God provided in the wilderness. Jesus has then replicated that by providing physical bread from heaven in our miracle story today. God is the source of this bread, but God is also the supplier of a different type of bread, a living bread, a spiritual bread that, if eaten, the one who eats it will have life, will live forever. Well, this bread sounds pretty good. And the people that hear this teaching in the synagogue at Capernaum are pretty keen to eat it. "Sir," they said in verse 34, "give us that bread every day. We want life. We want the good stuff. Give us this bread from heaven that you're telling us about, Jesus." Well, Jesus' words get harder to hear from this point. He tells them that he, in fact, is this bread. That he came down from heaven, God as the incarnate Son Jesus, and all who believe in Jesus, whoever comes to him, will have eternal life. But then he goes even further. In verse 51, Jesus says, "I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Anyone who eats this bread will live forever, and this bread which I will offer so the world may live is my flesh." Now Jesus is saying that Jesus is the living bread, but in order for the benefits of this bread to be received, this living bread must be sacrificed. See, Jesus will go to the cross. He will sacrifice his own flesh on that cross. He will die. He will give himself so that we who eat the living bread, that is, we who believe in Jesus, who accept the gift of the bread that comes with Jesus' death, will also live with him. Can you see how far we've come? We've gone from earthly bread to heavenly bread to Jesus as bread, to Jesus as bread to eat, i.e. believe in Jesus, to Jesus as sacrifice. The true bread from heaven who gives life to the world far outstrips the manna in the wilderness. We're shortly going to finish up and we're going to move into a time of communion, but there's one thing that I haven't commented on yet that I want to draw our attention to. And that's the responses of the people who were with Jesus. Those who witnessed the miracle, who heard the teaching. See, broadly there are three groups of people. And as our highlight, their response to Jesus, I wonder which group you might resonate most strongly with this morning. And within that group, those three groups of people, what is it that God might be saying to us today? What will your response, what will our response to Jesus be? I've represented these three groups of people in a diagram of concentric circles. It's up on the screen. It may look like I've made a mistake. I haven't made a mistake. Let me explain to you the three groups of people. The first group of people on the outside in the yellow, that's the crowd. The crowd who followed Jesus to see what he would do next. The crowd who had been fed with bread and fish and thought they had factual evidence that the prophet, like Moses, was present among them. If we go one circle in, into the blue circle, we have disciples, but we don't have the disciples. We have disciples. They're followers of Jesus. They had in some sense committed themselves to Jesus, made some sort of allegiance to Jesus, but it's not the 12. It's a broader group of people who had attached themselves to Jesus, but Jesus hadn't individually chosen them, if that makes sense. They had attached themselves to Jesus. They were following him around. They were, in some sense, committed to him. And the next circle in, our pinky purple circle, they are the disciples, capital T for the. They're the 12 disciples, the disciples that Jesus personally called to follow him. So let's work from the outside in. Let's see which group of people each of us might resonate most strongly with and what God might be saying to us in that. So the first group of people is the crowd. What was the crowd's response to Jesus? Well, verse 15 tells us they were ready to force Jesus to be their king. The crowd saw an opportunity to be liberated from Roman rule, and Jesus would be the king to free them. That wasn't Jesus' agenda, was it? See, the crowd, they had their own agenda. They had their own plans and ideas. They were willing to be physically fed and healed by Jesus. But perhaps they didn't know him very well, and they weren't willing to sacrifice their plans to Jesus' mission. I wonder if that resonates with you this morning. You might have said yes to Jesus' call to discipleship. That may have been recently, or it may have been a long time ago. But you may feel like you're in a space at the moment where you're struggling to let go of some of your own plans and ideas and to hand those over to God. This is where the call to discipleship looks different for each of us. And for each of us, there will be different things that are hard to let go of as we align our will with God's will. And if you feel like that, maybe that's ringing true for you this morning, can I encourage you to keep finding out more about Jesus? To sit before God's word and explore what Jesus is on about, what his priorities are. Maybe read it with someone else. See, the better we understand Jesus and his mission, the easier it is for our plans to be God's plans. Maybe is that what God is challenging you about today? Well, if we move on to the next circle, so we move from the crowd, we have disciples. This wider group of people, unnamed, we don't know who they were, who were following Jesus. And their response to Jesus and his teaching, their response comes in verse 66 of chapter 6. And it says this, it's a brutal verse. At this point, many of his disciples turned away and deserted him. They found his teaching to be too hard, possibly even scandalous with some of the language Jesus uses about eating flesh and drinking blood. See, they didn't understand what Jesus was saying, and instead of seeking understanding, they threw in the towel and they turned their back on Jesus. If you're feeling like that today, then can I encourage you in our time of communion We're going to have communion shortly. Can I encourage you in our time of communion to just come? Just come and be fed on the bread and the juice. And let the reminder that Jesus died as a sacrifice to enable our relationship with God, let that be a simple truth for you this morning. Of course, we can go deeper than that. And it's a good thing to grapple with all of Jesus' teaching, whether it's easy teaching or hard teaching. And there's a time and a place for that grappling with Jesus' teaching. But sometimes too, it's really helpful to just allow ourselves to step back and to still our minds, to let Jesus, to let God speak into that space that we're in, and just to be awed by the simplicity of God's love for us. We had the verse read out, didn't we? God shows his love for us by sending his son Jesus to die for us. Well, that's two of the circles. And the third one, the final response we have, is the innermost circle. And that's the response of the disciples, the 12 disciples. Here we have examples of men who, they don't know everything about Jesus. They're still listening and learning and following the best that they can with the information that they have. We see that from Philip and Andrew's response to the apparent conundrum of feeding so many people in verse 5 and 7. Philip's response in verse 7 when he says, even if we worked for months, we wouldn't have enough money to feed everyone. It shows that Philip, he hasn't yet grasped completely Jesus' miraculous ability. Jesus here tests Philip, and in a sense, Philip failed the test. But did you notice what's missing from the text? Jesus doesn't tell Philip off for his lack of faith. He doesn't discipline him. He doesn't judge him. No, instead, Jesus shows Philip his power. Jesus confirms to Philip that he is someone who is worth having faith in, who is worth following. And the disciples, they realize this by the end of the chapter. When Jesus asks the 12 disciples if they're going to leave as well, Simon Peter turns around and in that famous verse, Simon Peter says, Lord, to whom would we go? You have the words that give eternal life. We believe and we know that you are the Holy One of God. This is a statement of faith, an affirmation of their response to Jesus' call to discipleship. It's a commitment to follow Jesus. They don't know what's ahead. They do know that they don't know everything. You see, it's discipleship with stickability despite the unknowns. If this is something that maybe resonates more strongly with you for this morning, can I encourage you to persevere in following Jesus, to keep fighting the good fight, to keep running the race? Not out of simply going through the motions, but a recognition that there's beauty in the depth of God's grace and God's love. And in our discipleship, we are called to follow, but to put our faith in a God who will keep revealing himself to us, who will keep revealing himself to us as we get to know him more and more. Does this resonate most strongly with you this morning? Maybe God has a challenge for you in this as you journey and follow Jesus. Well, we'll head into communion very shortly. But just before that, we're just going to have a minute or two of some instrumental music. This is an opportunity to sit quietly, to reflect, to think about this passage and to think about those three groups of people and just allow God to speak into that space. To think about maybe where you're at this morning and what God might be saying to you, what God might be challenging you on this morning. And then shortly, we'll share in communion together.